man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm gonna get that gun of mine, and I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host this week, Alonzo Duraldi. Drea and Iffy are out of town this week. How nice for them. But in their stead, we have a dilly of a program and some very exciting guests. We're joined by film reporter for the LA Times and self-styled karaoke monster, Jen Yamato.
Okay, woo! I did not realize you were going to put my actual biography in this introduction.
Well, you know, we keep it real around here. Jen, what's good with you?
What is good with me? I'm so happy to be here.
Well, yay.
Because
us too.
Before being here, I was in El Segundo, our offices.
Well, I was going to say, why? But okay. Then.
The El Segundo Times.
Sure.
Working on a story.
Internationally known.
But what's good with me lately is, this is maybe a strange thing, random thing, but I've been listening to a lot of Gladys Knight.
Nice.
With or without Pips?
With Pips.
Good.
Always with
and
Pips.
I think I might be entering a Gladys Knight phase.
Now, is this going to spill over into the karaoke?
Well, yes, obviously.
Okay, gotcha.
That's kind of, they go hand in hand. For probably the last 5 or so years, I was definitely in a Celine phase. Before that, I've been in Whitney phases and Mariah phases. So now I think... I think I'm going Gladys.
Do you have to get your own Pips now, or do they are they pre-recorded on the track?
Pip, that's a great idea.
You should get your own Pips.
If you're interested, there's an opening.
She's leaving on that midnight train to Georgia.
We don't actually own the rights to that.
No,
we're in serious trouble.
I think we're in fair use. That's fine.
Okay.
That voice you heard is from film critic and host of the Cancel Too Soon podcast, William Bibbiani.
Hello. How
First
is
time
everybody?
On the show. Bibbs, welcome. What's good?
Oh, a lot of things are good. But most recently, I went to Book of Beasts, the bestiary in the medieval world over at the Getty Center.
Ooh. Tell me more.
It is a really wonderful exhibition they have over there. It's only there for a couple more weeks. Bestiaries were books of zoological studies, and they would have everything we currently know about lions. They know nothing about lions. and everything we know about unicorns, which of course are real if you just go to Germany. And so it's full of these wonderful, like, gilded books that are full of, like, Latin information that's all wrong, and pictures from people who've heard vaguely of rhinoceroses, but it's totally wrong, and full of magical creatures which they assumed were real. And there's a ton of really fascinating stuff in it. There's like a magical beast I didn't know of that's like a bull, but its horns are backwards, so it can't like gore you in self-defense. So what does it do to protect itself from hunters and predators? It has fiery, like flaming, like on fire flatulence that can cover hundreds of acres.
You know,
so that just don't
that
get
seems
behind
fair.
It. Yeah, so there's that. There are tons of these like water jugs that look like fantastical creatures, but all of the water jugs, doesn't matter what it is, doesn't matter if it's an elephant or a unicorn, every single one of them, the handle looks like a fox giving them a back rub. And that's the thing I really wanted to ask questions about, and no one knew any answers, was why are foxes giving back rubs to literally every animal in the animal kingdom? That's the mystery of the bestiary.
This
I hope
is
you
fantastic.
Check it out.
Fantastic.
This sounds like a fantastic beast and where to find them that doesn't suck.
It really was quite wonderful, and it's a really cool exhibition, and yeah, I recommend checking it out.
Nice.
While you still can. What's good with you?
That's so exciting. Wow. I just figured you weren't going to.
I thought you were in charge and you were just going to ask yourself like a big, powerful man that you are.
Usually it's the other people.
Okay.
Anyway,
good?
Thank you for asking. What's good is the LP1217 GSR. That's the air conditioner that we just installed in our apartment. I'm so excited. Like, you know, Dave and I have lived in that place for 20 years, and we've had a little teeny tiny carbon footprint and very low electric bills. But you know what? Climate change is real. And over the course of 20 years, the hottest days of summer have gotten hotter.
Yeah, that small carbon footprint you had didn't help.
Yeah.
Get an air conditioner.
And there's more of them. And also, you know, we are elderly gays, and old people die when it gets hot, and there's not enough air conditioning.
Elderly. Surely
we're
not.
Elderly gays. You're
only as young as you feel.
Exactly. Like I said, elderly. So now we have an air conditioning unit, and I'm super excited. Do your worst, summer. I'm ready for you.
I can finally visit during the summer.
It's August.
honey, you know it didn't get hot here until like the end of July.
Strangely, it rained today, this morning.
Crazy.
At my house.
But it's going to be hot till Thanksgiving. That's just how it goes.
True.
You know, we get a late summer and then it lingers.
Oh, that's so true.
This is so exciting. On today's show, we're talking about Fast and Furious Presents Hobbs and Shaw, and these are the two people that I most wanted to talk to about it.
Yay!
So that's going to be awesome. We're also going to take a call from the Who Shot Line, and of course, as always, we've got staff picks. But first, it's time for our new segment called It a Dick. Short for Is This Important? Do I Care? I'll be reading new segments, and we'll all answer the questions. Is this important? Do I care? Starting off with the death of D.A. Pennebaker. The documentary filmmaker died this week at the age of 94. Throughout his career, he made 60 films and helped popularize the verite style of documentary filmmaking. Some of his best-known docs include Monterey Pop, The War Room, and Bob Dylan, Don't Look Back. In 2013, the Academy awarded him a lifetime Oscar for his entire body of work. Is this important? Do you care?
Heck yeah.
Yes.
To both counts.
Indeed.
Yes. I'm just gonna bow out of this one. I'm not particularly familiar with his films. I haven't watched a lot of his films.
Right.
So I'm just gonna let everyone else talk on this one. I'm just gonna
be
embarrassed and
I envy
you getting to see them for the first time.
Isn't that the fun part? But yeah, no, seriously, like I don't think I've seen any of his films all the way through.
You know, I had a recent Pennebaker moment, which was that earlier this year, Documentary Now aired an episode that was a parody of original cast album Company. And that was Pennebaker shooting the recording of the Stephen Sondheim Broadway show Company. It was supposed to be the pilot for an ongoing series of original cast recordings being filmed. They never made another one, but they made this one. And it's this incredible snapshot of this complicated show and its complicated score. And you've got like Elaine Stritch in the middle of the night, like they finally get to her big song and she's exhausted. You've got Stephen Sondheim, who's never satisfied with anything, and Hal Prince, who directed the show, trying to make it all work. And so I had a friend over and we watched that one, and then we watched the Documentary Now, and they have such fun with the specifics of Pennebaker's style, because I'm of the school, like, they wrote verite in the script, and for me, verite means, like, you can see people holding the microphones and the tape on the floor, but he definitely has a very sort of unvarnished you are there thing, the you're in the room feeling, you know, that he brings to a lot of the films, and so it was exciting to dig that one out and watch it again, because I think it's so great. Jen, what are your faves?
Well, I think that he's well known for his work in the music documentary field.
Sure.
But what he did within that field is so different from, you know, these concert docs that we see now. You see, like, Bob Dylan, Don't Look Back, really was up close and personal with Bob Dylan in this great, unvarnished, very intimate, observational way. And it's just fascinating to see how Pennebaker sort of made that medium personal without, like, really saying anything himself. But you feel his perspective. You feel him watching and trying to figure out this person in front of him as he's filming. And I think that's one of the great, beautiful things about some of the ways that he made these movies. The Monterey Pop documentary, which was made around the same time, I love this one moment, the Janis moment, you know, where he's filming Big Brother and Janis. They're, like, explosive performance. She's singing Ball and Chain,
right?
And you cut to Mama Cass in the audience going, wow. And one of my favorite tidbits about that is that was spliced together from two different performances and two different days, but the way that he sort of, you know, cuts them together,
right?
Like, one is obviously during like a different time, but he cuts it together in a way that gives you the emotional impact of what he was seeing. And what he was seeing was these artists watching each other in that moment, and Mama Cass watching Janis emerge in that moment.
I love the fact that the guy who did Bob Dylan, Don't Look Back, also did Depeche Mode 101. Like, that's some pretty eclectic stuff.
I would like to know what he listened to on Spotify.
Oh, God, totally.
You know?
He might have rejected Spotify outright, though.
Could be.
Might be one of those cool kids.
Yes.
Maybe. He actually has CDs.
He had a Zune. All right. In a recent interview with Total Film Magazine, the director of It Chapter 2, Andy Muschietti, discussed the need to use CGI to de-age the group of teens known as the Losers from It Chapter 1. The sequel film follows the Losers as adults, so when there are flashbacks to the events of the first film, the kids need to stay relatively the same age, but since they're kids and it's been a few years since shooting the first film, they all look pretty different. According to Muschietti, from the beginning, we knew that would be part of the budget, the visual effects to address that, so we're going to de-age the kids. Is this important? Do you care?
No and no. It's completely irrelevant. We've had this technology for a bit. We've been digitally de-aging people for a while. I love that this is suddenly like a big deal because they're going to do it to some child actors and not like Michael Douglas.
I was going to say, we're used to being Michael Douglas or Samuel Jackson in Captain Marvel,
but like,
or whatever.
It makes sense. We've had this problem where like we have so much serialized entertainment now. That's kind of a big thing. And when we have serialized entertainment, if you cast someone who's young and then they hit puberty and then they change, it can really mess up a project. Look what happened to Walt on Lost, where they do Lost and every episode's like one day on the island.
Oh, right.
But they cast like this kid and some between seasons he just shot up a foot and all of a sudden the continuity doesn't work at all and you can't do any flashbacks with him and they're like, oh crap, we have to write him and this really important sounding subplot off the show. If you could just digitally de-age him, cool.
Sure.
To play devil's advocate.
Oh, dude.
Not that I have like a huge objection to this, but I think it's really interesting to think of the idea of de-aging as going against the natural order of life.
Sure.
You know? And my question for this, you know, this case, which being the It Chapter 2, de-aging its kids, make the kids look younger headlines. It's interesting because, like you said, we've done it before. We've seen it done before.
Sure.
To make old dudes look less old. And I wonder how good it's going to look.
I mean, I've seen it all depends on how much they have to do, I guess. I mean, if it's just a matter
if they grew 6 inches, that's going to be tricky. But you know, if it's just a question of erasing the stubble, the wispy mustache, I don't know.
You're right. If they're just painting out some stubble, you know, maybe you won't even notice it.
A couple of tweaks here or there, but yeah, some people change dramatically. I remember in the Harry Potter stories where like Daniel Radcliffe still looks basically like Daniel Radcliffe but taller, but then Tom Felton between Chamber of Secrets and Prisoner of Azkaban, like, turned into a different human being.
Oh, who's like, the one that started out, like, total nerd boy, and by the end of it was, like, a smoking hot, like,
Dudley.
20-year-old. Yes.
Dudley. Not Dudley.
Not Dudley.
Neville.
Neville Longbottom. Whoever,
Neville would have done it in four
Neville
books.
Neville Longbottom. Whoa!
Hence, hot Neville memes.
Totally. Yes.
The best memes.
So with de-aging, we're not going to get those memes.
I'm fine.
It's a necessary evil, but I don't care.
As long as we all agree that it is a remake,
I don't think it's all that important either. Well, speaking of redoing and remaking things, it was revealed this past Tuesday during Disney's earnings call that the studio plans to, quote, reimagine, unquote, a number of properties in the 20th Century Fox library for their upcoming streaming service, Disney Plus. Some of the movies that are going to be rebooted are Night at the Museum, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Home Alone, and Cheaper by the Dozen. You may recall Disney purchased Fox for $71.3 billion a little while back and now has control over these films. It is unclear whether these titles will be rebooted as movies or as TV shows. Is this important? Do you care?
Yes, but probably not for the reasons people expect. Not because I think Home Alone is sacred or Diary of a Wimpy Kid is sacred, but because here we have Disney finally revealing its hand. And we have all these people who are like, oh, Disney's not going to cancel all the original films going on at Fox and only just focus on all the franchises and suck all of the originality that Fox brought to the studio market. No. They'll keep things going pretty much normal. And then Disney wiped the slate clean at Fox and they're not going to do any new stuff. And
shuttered Fox 2000 and they fired everybody.
Yeah,
and
Fox
now
Searchlight is going, but I'm seriously wondering how long that's even going to last at this point. So I care because it's just Disney, just, you know, they're like Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. They're just Disney is just the miners and the thing pull out like a big sparkly, ooh, Diary of a Wimpy Kid. Put that in the cart.
They have a new vault to plunder.
I think everything that Disney is doing now in regards, especially to Fox, is very interesting and warrants deeper scrutiny. For example, recently it has been, you know, certainly tweeted about that Disney is limiting repertory titles, Fox repertory titles, from being allowed to be shown in theaters.
Yeah, you can't rent them and put them in your theater.
Because Disney has always had its own weird policies about that. And rather than let Fox exist the way they used to, they are treating them like Disney's titles.
Disney doesn't want people to access their movies unless they specifically want them to. It's why when The Lion King got put in theaters this summer, they took out the original Lion King from a lot of streaming services, or at least
you could buy it off iTunes, but you couldn't rent it.
Exactly. Yeah. So, like, they're control. It's vertical integration,
right? And so, I mean, I feel like, you know, 5-10 years ago, we were aware that Disney treated its quote unquote vault this way, its own, you know, classic Disney titles that, you know, they only re-released very intentionally every now and then. But for that to apply now to the Fox titles that they have inherited, I think is going to change even more than maybe we realize right now.
I mean, who the hell knows if even like their Disney, their like old Fox titles are going to be on those Disney streaming services. Fox is older than Disney as a studio.
Sure, yeah.
So who the hell knows if we're going to have access to any of their titles?
Disney
in the
owns
30s.
Sunrise now. I never thought about that. You're right.
Disney owns Wings, for God's sake. Like, oh, Disney, wow. Like, that's a lot of
that's
stuff.
That's Paramount, actually.
Is it? Okay, well, then I might be
but
wrong
that's
about
where
that.
This,
but regardless, like, who knows what's going to happen to all of
this? And that's where this sort of side issue matters, is if what repertory theaters are allowed to program is severely, you know, limited, then I feel like that's going to impact a lot of the film scene.
Well, I remember when they announced that, Disney's going to have everything on their Disney streaming service. No, you are not.
Yeah.
You are not going to have Song of the South.
Never.
And I don't blame you for that, but let's not advertise it as having everything.
Frankly, as long as they have Newsies, I'm okay.
As long as they have the 100 Lives of Black Jack Savage, I'm okay. Disney, I know you're listening.
Trenchcoat? Okay, I got nothing.
The 100 Lives of Black Jack Savage better be on that damn service. If you don't know what I'm talking about, it was a short-lived TV series in which Donald Trump buys a haunted mansion in the Caribbean and teams up with the ghost of a rapping black pirate to solve mysteries using a sci-fi superboat. That was a thing you did, Disney. That needs to be available. It's from the creators of Final Destination. Make it available. Thank you. Moving on.
I think it's plum for a remake. Yeah. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking about Hobbs and Shaw, or Fast and Furious Presents : Hobbs and Shaw, just as soon as we hear from another show on Maximum Fun.
Hi, everybody. My name is Justin McElroy.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
We're both doctors. And
nope, just me.
Okay, well, Sydney's a doctor, and I'm a medical enthusiast, and we create Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine.
Every week, I dig through the annals of medical history to bring you the wildest, grossest, sometimes dumbest tales of ways we've tried to treat people throughout history.
And lately, we do a lot of modern fake medicine, because everything's a disaster, but it's slightly less of a disaster every Friday right here on MaximumFun.org as we bring you Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. And remember,
don't drill a hole in your head.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Alonzo Duraldi. In the studio with me are
William Bibbiani.
Oh, I'm Jen Yamato.
You are.
Hi.
Today we're talking about Fast and Furious Presents Hobbs and Shaw. Here's the storyline from IMDb. Lawman Luke Hobbs and outcast Deckard Shaw form an unlikely alliance when a cyber-genetically enhanced villain threatens the future of humanity.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. Okay. So, does this movie need to exist? In the sense that any movie needs to exist.
Well, no movie needs to exist. I mean, if you want to keep the Fast and Furious franchise going without having to get 12 actors of prominence in the same room every time, which is a scheduling nightmare, you got to start doing spinoffs. So on that level, the studio is very eager to make this work. And I get it, because Jason Statham and Dwayne Johnson have a lot of chemistry together. They're fun when they hate each other. So on that level, yeah, I can kind of see it. If you don't mind watching a big blockbuster movie about an unrepentant murderer getting away with it, knock yourself out.
And that brings us to hashtag justice for Han, and that is why I wanted Jen Yamato to be here.
Justice!
Walk us through it. Let people know the lay of the land here and what the hell is going on.
Okay, so, guys, there were a bunch of Fast and Furious movies that became faster and furiouser to a greater degree the more that the franchise went on. We've seen 8 of those in the main core franchise hit theaters. Fast 9 is currently being filmed with Justin Lin, thank God, coming back to direct. But along the way, Universal, who has made a bajillion dollars with this very inclusive, I might add, franchise that started from very, very humble, brooding East LA Vin Diesel.
I live my life a quarter mile at a time.
That's right.
Doesn't matter if you win by an inch or a mile. Winning is winning.
So a lot has
happened. You've got an engine for a brain and Nas for blood. Okay.
I didn't realize you guys had so much in you. So, okay, it's one of the biggest franchises on the planet.
Yes,
and with this move, you see Universal doing what Disney has done with Star Wars movies, for example, which and Marvel, certainly, which is keep your main franchise going linearly and then add in a bunch of side adventures.
Right.
So they spun off Hobbs and Shaw, two characters that were introduced in Fast 5 and Fast 6, both introduced initially as adversaries to the main heroes, both who have, to varying degrees of success, in my opinion, been now turned from the enemy into allies to the hero. So,
family, Jen. They're family.
It's about family.
Do you consider Hobbs family, though?
He's a cousin.
You know, he's like a distant cousin.
We invite him to weddings.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
However, Shaw, Deckard Shaw, is no family. And here's why. When the franchise first started experimenting drastically, and I would argue changing the form of what franchises could be and how they could evolve, it was Fast and Furious 3, Tokyo Drift, directed by Justin Lin, which initially was a totally different, would have been direct-to-DVD, unrelated, you know, canonically story about a American teenager who learns how to drift race in Tokyo, until they added on this Vin Diesel cameo reprising his role from the first movie of Dominic Toretto, street racer, and thus they sort of tied all three of the movies together, and then they've sort of kept evolving since then. But the best character in Tokyo Drift is Han,
yes,
played by actor Sung Kang, and at the end of Tokyo Drift, spoilers I guess, Han is killed in a fiery crash on the streets of Tokyo. Until, fast forward to Fast and Furious 6, the end of Fast and Furious 6, there's a surprise cameo.
Wait, you're skipping the part where Han then returns to the...
Episodes 4 through 6 were all interquels.
Yes.
Because we met Sung Kang, and in every single film, he was always just like, you know, one of these days I've been meaning to go to Japan. But he doesn't go until the end of 6.
Because he's such a great character.
Yeah.
He is legit a member of the hashtag family that Justin Lin and, you know, Chris Morgan, the producers, kept him around.
Gal Gadot dies saving his life.
Yep.
At the end of...
That's how much we love him.
Six.
Yeah, on the world's longest runway.
Yes, that one. Yeah.
Yes. It's fantastically memorable. These are very integral side characters. His death meant something because they brought him back for 3 more movies afterwards.
So at the end of 6...
At the end of 6...
We see him driving in Tokyo, and he is killed...
Again, in a reprisal,
we're seeing it from a new angle.
Yes,
right.
And we then see the person responsible for Han's death this whole time was Jason Statham,
Deckard Shaw,
who walks away from the Han crash and calls Vin Diesel's Dominic Toretto and basically is like, "I'm coming for you." Boop. And then the next movie, he is the big bad going after the entire Toretto clan.
Yeah.
And now we're just supposed to forget all that happened.
All of a sudden he's at barbecues and stuff, and we're supposed to be fine with that. And I'm like, no, Han is dead. You killed him.
Thank you.
People who liked him are still like in movies with you. And the only person who seems to still be mad about anything is Dwayne Johnson. Well, you, but in the movies, it's Dwayne Johnson. But like Dominic Toretto's just like, eh, whatever. I interviewed the filmmakers. I think you've interviewed them too. And like they always have these like really limp excuses. Like I interviewed like Chris Morgan and he was like, well, you know, when we first met Dominic Toretto, he had gone to jail for beating someone up with like a wrench. So it's kind of the same thing. No, it is not. That is academic at best because that happened off screen. We saw him kill a character we love.
And that said, I have also spoken with Chris Morgan, and every single time I obviously bring up Justice for Han, which is the hashtag rallying cry that real fans use to point out that it's still not okay to accept Deckard Shaw into this family of heroes now. And every time I mention it, Chris Morgan, I mean, we have a conversation about how great Han is. So I know that he's aware. I know that he listens is maybe the most important takeaway from this conversation. They listen to the fans. So if the fans keep, you know,
well, Chris Morgan did just say that it was going to come up again later, which then prompted Michelle Rodriguez to tweet, "You're not having anything to do with where this narrative is going anymore."
Yeah,
Chris
he's out of the game.
So
on that, yeah.
Now, Jen, in your really, I think this is Pulitzer, if not Nobel material. You asked Jason Statham, WTF?
I did.
Ooh.
And
how did that go?
Well, I think by now, probably everybody involved in any Han storyline knows that I'm gonna.
Yeah. So he was ready for you. He was prepared.
Yes, and he acknowledged that he knows it's a problem, basically, or rather, he knows that it needs to be addressed, is what he said. Mm-hmm. And both he and Chris Morgan point to this line in Hobbs and Shaw, which again sort of reframes the Deckard Shaw character as a good guy who teams up with The Rock to save the world, and there's a line where Deckard Shaw says, I have things I've done that I need to make amends for. Yeah. It's very, very ambiguous.
Right. Oh,
very
not,
vague.
That's not enough for me, but all right.
So, I mean, that's all we have to cling to.
I did notice that, yeah.
Right? And so Statham said, basically, just wait. There's more to come. We have more of Deckard Shaw's story to reveal. And I think that probably also applies to all of the sort of after the fact added on canon that they're trying to expand around these side characters as well. Mm-hmm. You see in Hobbs and Shaw the introduction of this Idris Elba character as the main villain.
From Shaw's past.
Shaw's past, which we didn't know about till now. They refer to falling out that they had. You could say it's a workplace falling out that they had 8 years ago, which in, you know, Fast and Furious time 8 years ago, 2011, which would have been Fast and Furious 5. So they're sort of Universal sort of building retroactively this back story.
Well, they've done that before. I mean, including Han et al. Was retroactively including Better Luck Tomorrow, which also retroactively includes Annapolis, which also has characters in Better Luck Tomorrow.
But that's more the Justin Lin verse.
Well, but also F. Gary Gray put a character from the Italian Job in Fate of the Furious. So, like, there's a lot.
And Hobbs and Shaw makes an Italian
Job.
Exactly. So I think that one might be officially canon. But why did he not put anyone from Set It Off? That's ridiculous. Jada Pinkett is out there.
I agree.
Okay,
no argument here. All right, before we go too far down a rabbit hole, let's talk about actual Hobbs and Shaw.
Yeah.
How is this thing? How is this thing as a movie? What do we think?
What do you think, Lonzo?
Yeah,
you've been quiet.
I've been having this thing lately where it's not so much that I don't like the movie I'm watching; it's that I don't like that all I get is the movie I'm watching. Like, during the third act of Spider-Man Far From Home, a movie I thoroughly enjoyed and think is very, very well made, when we get to the big CGI battle, as much as I like the movie, there was a part of me that just thought, could we wait? You know, the idea, and I've talked about this on the show, the idea that we're not going to get another Marvel movie until May of next year, I'm thrilled. I want to miss them again. Watching this movie is the kind of movie that in years past I would have joyfully said, oh, it's gloriously stupid. It knows how dumb it is, and it's just an adrenaline machine and a thrill ride, and isn't that fun? And that is fun when it's different and when it's an alternative. But when all they make are aggressively stupid thrill rides, I lose the thread, you know.
And I don't get tired of them though. Like that's the thing for me. Like,
I am now.
Well, because you just said to yourself, it's all a matter of kind of mood. You're tapped out. And as a film critic, we see everything. Yes. So we get tired of trends way faster than everyone else.
No, I get it. If you go to a movie four times a year, then you're not going to get tired of anything.
And that's fine. I just think Hobbs and Shaw isn't doing anything terribly different than what they did in Fate of the Furious or Fast and Furious 6 or any of the other ones we like. It's just now, all of a sudden, we're tired of it. And I don't think that's necessarily the movie's fault.
And that's what I'm saying. It's not the movie's fault. It is the menu's fault. Yeah. It is the fact that this is what studios make now, and they make them all the time, and what we used to call a summer movie is now just a movie because that's all they make.
Well, I do think that Hobbs and Shaw does do several things very differently from the Fast and Furious movies, starting with the tone. The core Fast movies still have this sort of rather melodramatic center of seriousness, even though it's a winking. It's like a winking but still soapy tone. And Hobbs and Shaw knows and is trying to be a comedy, an action comedy.
Yes.
You see that with the director David Leitch really shows his Deadpool 2 hand in many ways here.
They really lean on the banter.
Yeah. And not just banter between Hobbs and Shaw. They introduce these characters and cameos that probably they're going to try to bring back in the future. Yeah. Hobbs and Shaws.
Sure.
And I think it's trying to go for a standalone feel. It's trying to give people an alternative to what they can expect from the main movies that still makes them want to live in this world where, even though we never hear his name, we never hear the name Dominic Toretto, we know he's over there somewhere.
Yes.
Doing something.
Well, and I still think that they're not moving too far afield because it is still all about family. We have Dominic Toretto's sister, Helen Mirren, comes back for not long enough. How have they not gotten her behind the wheel of a car? It's ridiculous. But so we still have an element of that there. We still have an element of that little melodrama. But you're right. It's still all the action is just as absurd as ever. I would love to watch this movie with a physicist or someone
watch their brains explode.
A truck wouldn't do that, and then they die.
I have long referred to this as Universal's superhero franchise.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and I think with Idris Elba, we get a literal super.
Well, that's Hobbs and Shaw. As much as this franchise has evolved from a very sort of romantic, very macho two-hander with muscle cars, now it's a full-blown sci-fi movie.
Yeah. Right.
You know?
But what bugged me was there are two backstories in this movie that happen to multiple characters. We find out, at the beginning of the movie, we see Sister Hobbs, or Sister Shaw.
Hattie Shaw.
Played by Vanessa Kirby, who's great. We see her in a situation where it appears that she has killed everyone in her squad, but it's not true because Idris Elba really did. And we find out that years ago, Deckard Shaw was accused of killing his whole squad, but it's not true. Idris Elba did it.
Brixton Laura is really good at setting people up.
And then we also learn that that Sister Shaw went against the family by going into law and not crime like everybody else, and that's caused tension.
You see, everyone
and we
seems,
learn yeah. that Hobbs went into law and not crime like the rest of his family, and that caused tension. It's come on.
We seem like we're different people, and we fight because we seem like different people, but if they really got to know each other, they'd realize how alike they are. It's such a beautiful drama.
I feel like it's sort of, you see the seams showing where the people making this spinoff tried to, retain these core values that have come to define Fast and Furious, like family, but they're sort of forcing it into characters we don't know all that well now instead of earning it over the course of movies like the first movies did. But I will say, Dwayne Johnson and Jason Statham were both now producers on this movie. So that gave them both a lot more creative control over how their characters were developed. And I interviewed Johnson for the LA Times to talk about how he worked in his actual Samoan heritage into the film. And I think that's one of the best, most effective and emotional parts of Hobbs and Shaw.
Agreed.
Where you see Hobbs go home reluctantly to Samoa, where he's from. In real life, Dwayne Johnson is half Samoan and half Black Canadian. And so it's really nice to see him have this platform and be able to use it to bring his own heritage, a heritage that's very, very rarely ever seen in film or TV, into the biggest franchise on the planet.
And also, like, he is one of the world's biggest movie stars and has always been, like, the closest. They never really address the fact that he is not a white guy, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He, you know, he is in situations, it never comes up, it's never an issue, it's never contextualized in any way, and that's fine. It's not like every movie about a person of color has to be about that, but it's great that we've gotten to a point now where he can be like, yes, this is where I'm from, these are my people, and they're going to be in a movie, and that's going to be integral to the plot.
As much as I love that bit, though, it's all at the end, and it feels
that's
like the movie ends, and then they're just like, oh, we haven't gone to Samoa yet. Oh, okay. Well, there'll be another 45 minutes.
It's like, that's what my friend Ben David Grabinski refers to as the second third act of the film.
No, like seriously, it's like a huge finale. Like, it's awesome. The movie could end here if they just didn't arbitrarily decide that, like, MacGuffin A didn't work right. And so MacGuffin A didn't work right, and now we get to keep going forever.
But
and
mean,
just from a pacing perspective, it's frustrating. But
this
in a vacuum,
movie does
that
not need to be 2 hours and 15 minutes.
Well,
I'm sorry, it doesn't.
I think they do try, at least, and maybe the attempt itself is an acknowledgement that they know what's important to fans. They try to work in the themes of family. You know, we see Hobbs' family and Shaw's family, and they work in these sort of visual and dialogue shout outs to big moments, memorable moments throughout the franchise, like when Deckard Shaw sends his sister Hattie flying between two speeding vehicles, you know, he says, "Do you trust me?" That we think of Letty and Dom.
Right.
And when Idris Elba is chasing all of them and his motorcycle slides under this truck.
Mm-hmm. That's on the first film.
Exactly. That's how the Toretto crew, like, pulled off their heist.
His artificially intelligent motorcycle was a character. Like, how did they introduce it and it beeps at him? And I thought it was going to be like Herbie, like the hate motorcycle. And like, it never really paid off.
Yeah, no, I wanted more of a character there too. It's like Kit's evil twin.
Yeah,
or,
it was.
You know,
like, how have they not gone full Knight Rider on this?
I do think this showed me, not that I needed to know, but it there are moments in it that I think are really beautiful from Idris Elba.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a moment where his character, who is cybernetically enhanced, is getting a tune-up basically in the like bad guy tech lair, and there's this beautiful expression of this beautiful expressiveness on his face, without him having to say any dialogue that might be clunky or not, that shows you that it's, you know, a lot of things that he's going through. And I think that's like a beautiful moment that, you know, if you're watching this movie, whether or not you want to scrutinize it or not against anything, I think that's something that at least you can hold on to.
Well, right, one last thing I want to throw in. I think that both Statham and Dwayne Johnson are really talented comic actors.
Yeah.
And I found their banter really painful after about 5 minutes.
What?
Like, it felt so repetitive in one note that I was like, you guys are, like, I don't know if it was just the writing was bad, but I expect more from both of those guys.
I was fine with it, actually. I was like, whatever. They're both so handsome. I don't mind.
I feel like audiences have kind of, at least the audiences, I saw it twice, and both times the audiences around me loved every second of the comedy.
Mm.
So I think it really does still work for a lot of people.
Well, I saw it at a 9 a.m. show with very few people. So
there you go.
Joke's on me.
But, you know, the idea that, not to bring it back to Justice for Han, but to bring it back to Justice for Han.
What's most important.
Is I think this movie, what it does with the Shaw character and not adequately redeeming him as much as the filmmakers would like him to be successfully redeemed, it doesn't work.
No.
Because, you know, his motivation for killing Han, he says, and Statham told me, was for a good cause, is what he told me, because from Shaw's point of view, he was getting back at the Toretto crew for putting his brother in the hospital. His brother who
was alive, killed, by the way.
And who recovers in time to help Shaw save Toretto's baby in the last... And so now they're both redeemed and they're both alive.
And then on top of it all, like the disrespect for Han goes further even than the bad guys, because at the beginning of Furious 7, everyone's like, oh, we gotta get justice for Han. Han died. But at the end, they have forgotten that Han died and they make a way bigger deal about Brian retiring to a tropical island with his wife to live in luxury forever. But I understand the meta-narrative.
Totally earned that
disagree with... I think within the narrative, I don't think it is. I think in the narrative, your friend is retired, you're going to see them every single holiday, and
you could,
Han is
you
dead,
could still
and that
it
matters
them.
Less to you.
Well, I would agree
but they're
to
playing
say
on the
that
real thing.
They should also treat Han better.
Yes.
And part of that also, which is, I do think an important part of it, is Han was and still is the most prominent Asian character in the core Fast and Furious ensemble. And to do him so dirty so that Jason Statham can be propped up and redeemed enough to carry his own standalone feels a little bit counter to what the franchise has been telling us it's about.
Agreed.
You are right. So for our final review of Fast and Furious Presents Hobbs and Shaw, would you screen it, stream it, or skip it? Jen.
I still think people should screen it. I mean, big screen. Go see it. What else are you doing?
If you're someone who thinks that, like, that's what the big screen is for big action, I'd say screen it. Otherwise, I'd say stream it. It's fun, but, like, it's also really light. And I think it's okay if you wait on this one. Like, don't feel bad. It's okay. You don't have to see everything in a theater just because they tell you to.
Yeah, I'm kind of the school of, if this is the kind of movie you like to see big and you want, like, a giant soda and, you know, 2.5 hours of air conditioning, sure, screen it. Beyond that, you know, if you're worried about are you going to be able to keep up with the plot of this franchise, I think you could probably skip it. All right, we'll be right back after we hear from another show for Maximum Fun.
Welcome, everyone, to the live wrestling spectacular in Los Angeles.
So far, the world's most boring wrestling podcast has been destroying the competition.
Isn't there anyone who can save us from this travesty?
Wait, could it be?
It's Tights and Fights, the perfect wrestling podcast.
Tights and Fights is here to save us from the monotony of boring wrestling podcasts with hilarious conversations.
Woke trips through the history of wrestling.
And joke about the finer points of people wearing spandex.
One, two, three.
What a match!
And the Tights and Fights podcast will be back every week.
Thursdays on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get podcasts. Please, these hosts have families.
Tights and Fights podcast. Tights and Fights.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Alonzo Duraldi. In the studio with me today are...
I'm Jen Yamato.
And I'm William Bibiani.
And I'm not singing. I did that last week. Now it's time to answer a call from the Who Shot Line. Producer Casey, play us the call, please.
Hey, this is Jessica from Kentucky. I work in the medical field, and so a lot of times things in movies that relate to medical stuff drive me absolutely crazy. It's like a huge pet peeve. I'm like yelling in every movie, like, that's not how waiting hours work, or that's not where you would put that injection, or you can't just do that like that. It makes me crazy. So I was wondering if you all had any pet peeves based on, like, professions you've worked in or things you've experienced in real life that drive you crazy in movies. Yeah. Thanks, guys. Love the show. Bye.
Thanks, Jessica. That's a really good question.
That is
a lot of fun. It's specific to everyone because we all have experiences.
I have a lot of doctors in my family, so I'm sure they're totally on your page with that. No, that's not how you put the IV in the thing. There aren't a lot of movies about movie critics because filmmakers hate us.
Not the lead, anyway. We're usually the villain.
Exactly.
Who just shows up and at the end of The Greatest Showman. It's just like, I didn't like your stuff, but now I get it. You're a genius.
We're always some dopey side character. I do love, though, in My Best Friend's Wedding, where Julia Roberts plays a food critic, and she is in a restaurant where everybody knows that she's there and super excited about it, and she takes one bite and makes a pronouncement. And none of that is how food critics work. Like, they go incognito.
Yeah.
They do not announce that they're there.
They don't write their review in front of the chef just so that they feel better.
They order five different things and have a bite of each. Like, that, none of that is remotely true, and I'm not even a food critic, and I call bullshit on that one.
I got a bunch of these. My dad was a history nut. He has a degree in history, and so he was like a rivet counter with every World War II movie. But the one thing I picked up that I will never forgive any movie for doing this is when they put AD after the year.
Oh.
AD goes before the year. AD, the grammar, it's Latin. It's Anno Domini, in the year of our Lord, 1492 or whatever the hell it is. You put it afterwards, it doesn't work. No, they did not change that. People just did it so much that they said, screw it, fine.
No. But I mean, didn't they change it all to like BCE and...
Yeah, but most movies don't use that.
Well, sure.
That's common usage. So it always drives me nuts when 80 is after the year. Also, both my parents were educators. So anytime any teacher is in a movie, like, I can't watch School of Rock. He's sabotaging those kids' education. I don't care how entertaining it is. They're falling behind in their studies. That's some BS. The only movie or show I've ever seen accurately portray, like 100%, I can't find a flaw, accurately portray teaching is season 4 of The Wire.
Huh.
They nail it. Like, it's perfect.
Well, Dave White was a teacher, and he would tell you that election really nails
election ain't
how
bad.
Teachers feel about students.
Emotionally, yes. In terms of the way things actually run, not necessarily so much.
Jen?
Oh, I have one.
Oh, please.
When female journalists in movies end up hooking up with their subjects.
Oh!
There are so few female journalists portrayed ever in movies, but the majority of them, I swear, are so terribly portrayed. They're so terribly written. They're unethical. They almost always fall in love with their subject, and that's where, like, conflict comes from. And one of the worst offenders, in my mind, was 2014's Top 5 by Chris Rock.
Oh, yes.
Starring Chris Rock and Rosario Dawson, in which Rosario Dawson is assigned to, like, profile Chris Rock, who's, like, an actor. Mm. And so she spends a day with him, like, following him around, as you would for, like, a major print profile, whatever.
Yeah. Isn't she also a film critic?
Yes.
She's also a film critic. She's reviewed his stuff, and she's lying to him about who she is.
Thank you. She's lying to him about her identity. She also hooks up with him, and she uses a flip cam to interview him.
Oh. Also, by the way, Chris Rock has done press. He knows better than this. The junket for his film is being done the day the movie comes out.
Oh, right,
she's also doing this article, which her editor wanted yesterday for Thursday's edition. She's doing it today. Oh my God, you are not even going to get that transcribed until midday Saturday if you type 115 words a minute, which something tells me you don't, Rosario.
I did not expect you to remember this movie so well. I feel so seen right now. Thank you, guys.
It pissed me off.
I remember that.
Otherwise, the movie's quite charming.
I do want to end this off by noting that Bibbs, for the many things that he's brought to my life, is the reason that I'm addicted to Hallmark, and it's all your fault.
You're welcome.
Anytime a Hallmark movie has to deal with how apps work, going viral, anything that you can do on your phone, except actually make a call, they'll get it wrong in a Hallmark movie.
Every single time.
Their notion of technology and the internet and all of that stuff is insanely, like, 30 years behind.
Speaking of Hallmark-ish movies, yes. A Christmas Prince. Also, that happens.
I was going to bring that up. Thank you for reminding me. Yeah, because she's a journalist, but she lies about who she is.
And she breaks into the castle. She pretends to be a tutor and gets hired. Where's the other tutor, by the way? That never comes back up.
Yeah. How? What kind of royal family, like, does not bother to check anybody's references? And then in the sequel, she becomes like a blogger. But her blogger is gone viral because they don't know what that means. All right. Well, I hope that answers your question, Jessica. Thank you so much. And thank you to everybody who's called in. We're running low on Who Shot Line questions. So now's the time. Call in. The number for the Who Shot Line is WSY-803-1664. And hey, be like Jessica. Keep it brief. Now it's time for staff picks. This can be any movie that's in theaters, streaming, Passenger Pigeon, however people can get it. Bibbs, you want to start?
Okay, yeah. I want to talk about a movie that was criminally not just underseen, but reviled by people, often sight unseen when it first came out. And now it is on Netflix, and you have no excuse not to finally give an honest shot to Jupiter Ascending.
Amen.
Jupiter Ascending is a classic.
I third this.
Yes. Jupiter Ascending is the kind of movie where people are like, oh, there aren't any original like blockbusters with new ideas. We gave you Jupiter Ascending, and you did nothing with it.
Two words. Eddie Redmayne.
Eddie Redmayne gives an Oscar-worthy performance in this movie. Yeah, he's big and broad. You think he doesn't know? He did that on purpose. He did that for you. He did that for you, and you treated him like dirt. All you could talk about was that Theory of Everything movie. Nothing. Nothing compared to his performance in this. The Wachowskis made a big blockbuster sci-fi movie with flying sneakers and magic bees that was actually a hidden treatise on how every single movie about a girl who wants to be a princess is actually about indoctrinating her into a world of toxic wealth. It is a brilliant motion picture with really cool, really weird stuff in it, and you really should give it a try.
And original sci-fi.
Very original sci-fi. Yeah, it's great.
I didn't know I needed Channing Tatum with dog ears until I got Channing
Tatum.
He's
better with the dog ears.
It's a look. It
works. It's a great look.
Jen?
my pick is... wow, I don't know how I could match the energy of that. My pick is a movie that is currently in theaters, and I really encourage people to seek it out. It is called Loose, starring Kelvin Harrison Jr., directed by a filmmaker named Julius Ona. And it is a relatively, small ensemble, but it's really, really provocative. And I think, here's the premise. Kelvin Harrison Jr. plays Luce, who is this model high school student who was adopted by white parents from Africa as a child. And he has grown up to be the valedictorian, the star athlete of the school. And then one of his teachers, played by
Octavia
Spencer, who is also fantastic in the film, raises some suspicions about a paper that he wrote. And that's where the movie takes off. It is one of the most thrilling films, I think, of the year in many ways, and having to do with how director Julius Ona really modulates your expectations and plays on ideas of perception and identity and race. And it is one of, I think, the most thought-provoking films you can see right now.
And the parents are Naomi Watts and Tim Roth, right? So mine is actually, this is a film that is opening in New York exclusively this Friday when the show drops, but it's also going to be coming to LA in a couple weeks, and I imagine making its way around the country. So if it is not near you now, look for it and be ready for it. It's a documentary called Vision Portraits. It's made by a filmmaker named Rodney Evans, who did a great queer film several years back called Brother to Brother, about a young writer who becomes entranced with the Harlem Renaissance. And that young writer was played by a then unknown actor named Anthony Mackie. So this film is a documentary that Evans made about the fact that he has retinitis pigmentosa and is losing his eyesight, and trying to figure out what does that mean for him and his future as a filmmaker. And so over the course of the film, you find out not only about his own issues with vision, but he talks to a photographer, a writer, and a choreographer slash dancer, all of whom continue to create work even as their eyesight is diminishing. And so it's this really sort of inspirational on the one hand, this idea that, like, even without one of these major senses, you're the impulse to create is still there. But it's also this really kind of fascinating self-examination of somebody who just honestly doesn't know where his life is going and if he's going to be able to continue doing what he's always done. It's beautiful and moving and really well put together, and I really recommend it to people. So again, the film is Vision Portraits. Keep an eye out, and it's one you'll definitely want to check out. Now now it's time for our five-star reviews. If you leave us a five-star review, hey, we'll read it on the air. Like this one from Thimble Marie, who says, Who Shot Ya is my weekly guide to what I should be watching every week. The hosts are a wealth of knowledge, and I feel like I'm back in my favorite film studies course mixed with my terrible movie club of friends from college.
Guilty.
Keep up the fabulous work. Your discussions and opinions give me something to look forward to every Friday. Love from Florida, Angela. Well, thank you, Angela.
Aww, Angela.
Or Marie, whatever your real name is.
Whoever you are, you're wonderful.
We love you. Once again, the number for the Who Shot line is WSY 803-1664. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at Who Shot Ya Pod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/WhoShotYaPodcast, or send us an email at WhoShotYa@MaximumFun.org. Bibbs, Jen, y'all are the greatest. Where can people find you online?
Jen, go for it.
You can find me on Twitter at Jen Yamato. I was trying to think of a song to sing in defiance of your no singing today, but...
No singing!
Bibbs can be found on Twitter at William Bibbiani. You can also listen to my various podcasts. I'm jellical. I have various podcasts. I've canceled too soon, where we review TV shows less than one season or less. This week, it's the Weird Al Show, but people don't remember it.
Canceled too soon.
There you go. And I also have Critically Acclaimed, where we review new movies, the Two Shot, where we pair up one of the worst movies ever made with one of the best movies ever made every year, and we have a ton of exclusive podcasts on our Patreon, patreon.com/criticacclaim, including we're reviewing every single Best Picture nominee in chronological order, every single episode of Star Trek ever. There's a ton of stuff like that. Commentary tracks, check it out.
Bibbs and Whitney Seibold are doing amazing work. Go check them out. Listen to their stuff. And read Jen Yamato in the LA Times. She is essential.
Boop.
Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. This has been a production of MaximumFun.org. It has.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.